Good morning, everyone, and thanks for your patience. We all appreciate a good demonstration. And I got emails as I was rushing here about the other participants making their way here. So I'm Brenda Marston. I'm from the Cornell Human Sexuality Collection in New York. And I'm going to, and one of our speakers, Nakia, is, I think that's right, was unable to get here this morning. So we'll have time with the other two presentations, and we'll have those and then have a chance for good discussion with them afterwards. So first is Nicole Verdes, and she's from San Diego. She's an activist and a board president for Lambda Archives of San Diego in California. In 2013, she graduated with her master's degree in sociological practice from California State, San Marcos. Her thesis was called Cunning Linguists, Analyzing the Undoing of Gender in Riot Girl Zines. She utilized a feminist methodological approach to conduct a discursive analysis of 21 zines printed between 1991 and 1995 using Butler's theory of gender performativity as a theoretical framework. So welcome. So the next presentation is two people together talking about comics and podcasts by and for queer African youth, creative methods for contemporary queer archives. Alex Mueller is an associate professor at the University of Cape Town, where she works on community-led research projects that support queer advocacy and activism on the continent. She is also a member of the board of Triangle Project, one of South Africa's oldest LGBT organizations. Talia Meir is a researcher at the Gender, Health, and Justice Research Unit and a doctoral student in the Department of Sociology at the University of Cape Town. She's interested in the intersection of everyday life, identity, and violence.
Right. Hello, everyone. So we'll do this together, and you'll just see us talking sort of. We'll share the mic. And the project we want to talk to you about today is an attempt that we've done over the last year and a half to work with a group of young queer people from three countries, from Botswana, Kenya, and Zimbabwe, to create content that changes the way that queerness is currently represented on the African continent, and to also create content that's actually interesting to young people themselves. And I just as a disclaimer, we had hoped to show you some of our podcasts, but those are still very much in the making, so we'll focus what we talk about in terms of what you see on the comic book. We'll talk about the podcasts in the process, but unfortunately we're just not at the place where we have those yet. And to start off with, I mean, the reason why we wanted to do this project is that we as researchers were interested in how young queer people in Southern and East Africa see their everyday lives. And then I think we as, from our personal interests and sort of activist advocacy interests, were also just really wanting to make something that was different from what's currently available. And the reason for that is that when we talk about queerness on the African continent, it's either in a very public health developmentalist discourse, so we, you know about HIV and men who have sex with men, or we know about violence and discrimination and the impact of laws that criminalize same-sex relations. But it's very much focused on that. Or then often from also people within the continent, it is framed as un-African or not within traditions, and as a Western identity, so to say. And that really just lacks any kind of representation of everyday lives and realities, and especially any representation of young people.
Can I add also that it's especially hard to work with younger people in the context of Southern Africa and, well, Africa more broadly, because there's a lot of concern about recruiting young people into homosexuality. So when we started off this project, we actually wanted to work with teenagers, and the NGO partners that we were working with said we absolutely cannot officially work with people under the age of 18, because even though there's no laws against recruiting people into homosexuality, the perception that NGOs are recruiting young people is extremely damaging to the NGOs and can lead to detention. So that also means that there's very little popular representation of young people. There's no youth groups for queer people, young queer people, but there is much more representation of adults.
Yeah, I mean, I think that maybe just for context, all three countries, up to very, very recently, up to two weeks ago, all three countries have British colonial laws that criminalize same-sex relations. The penal codes are pretty much identical in all three countries. I'll talk about Botswana in a second. But the laws are implemented very differently. So in Zimbabwe, the law is on the books, and there have been records of arrests, of people having been arrested under it. In Kenya, the law is on the books, but it's not implemented as stringently. There's been two court cases recently to challenge the law as being unconstitutional. The High Court just ruled in May that, in fact, the law was constitutional, unfortunately. But what the laws usually do is that they obviously impact everyday life and they validate and justify stigma and discrimination. In Botswana is a little bit of a different case. The High Court 2 weeks ago ruled that the laws are unconstitutional. So 2 weeks ago, Botswana decriminalized same-sex activity, which is great. But it's also a really interesting time then for us to work with young people in these contexts where clearly things are shifting and you know, the laws are contested and social norms are being contested. Anyway. So what we actually did was to work with a group of 18 people, six people from each country. We initially met them in each country where we worked with local NGOs to find young people to work with, but also to be sure that whatever we did was held in a space where there was support available for people, both during and after the workshops. We had local counselors, and we really wanted this to be co-owned by the local NGOs in each country. And in the first workshop, we met people in their country, so six people per workshop. And we worked over 2 days, I guess sort of a kind of memory work. We got people to think about storytelling, telling the stories of their lives, what stories they wanted to share. And we used very creative methods to get them to think about their lives and their experiences. So we asked them to draw personal timelines. We asked them to map sort of their bodies or make mental maps of the city that they lived in to really get them to think about not just telling their stories, but also think about what stories they wanted to tell publicly and what that would be like. And we had a sort of group reflective process where every person presented their own creative work, and then the group reflected on it and also spoke about it. And we wanted that to be a moment where people could try out what parts of their stories they wanted to tell to other people in a fairly safe space, I mean, as safe as it could be. We then had a second workshop where we brought all people together in Nairobi, in Kenya. For a lot of the young people, it was the first time they traveled. So it was a big excitement overall anyway. And we were facilitating a group of 18 teenagers over a week. I felt very old. And at that workshop, we brought the people together with two comic artists and a radio journalist who made podcasts. And the idea was that in that week, they, for one, learned how to use audio devices to record their own podcast material. And we went through a whole process of getting them to record things. They decided what themes they wanted to work on. And then we brought them together with the comic artists to learn a little bit about storytelling in comic format and then decide for themselves which stories they wanted to tell. And each person sat with the comic artists to decide, that's a particular story that I want told in comic format. I want you to draw it in this particular way. And so almost like they wrote the script. And then we worked with the comic artists to get the illustrations right. Mm-hmm. And what we'll have out of this, I mean, we're almost there, not completely, is that we have a comic anthology that will be published by the Gay and Lesbian Archives in Action from Johannesburg, a queer publisher, sort of the only queer publisher on the continent. And we'll have podcasts that we want to sort of feed into more mainstream podcasts, existing podcasts like BBC Africa or Sound Africa. And the idea really is to queer the narrative in a way. For mainstream, but also for the young people themselves to have something they can use. So I'm going to go through this, I think, quite quickly. But really what we wanted to do is to do practice transformative decolonial work, work that generates new academic knowledge on the one hand, but also creates an output or more of a cultural product that contributes to an ongoing queer archive, especially from the continent. And that also goes beyond sort of the traditional academic outputs. So we're critiquing sort of the elitist
production of academic work and outputs. And we're hoping that through removing language barriers, it's also just much more accessible to the young people that have worked on it. We also think, I mean, traditionally cultural and especially creative expression is always often linked with agency of subaltern groups or grassroots movements and political activism. Zines, I think, are a very good example of that. So we really wanted to tap into that history. And really because it's also important that it's easier for people who are traditionally excluded from traditional research to really take control of that process. And that's really what we wanted to happen here, to one, work with a group that wasn't very represented in popular discourse or research, but also to make sure that that group of people had full control over how that process was going to happen, what was going to go into that, and what the outputs are. And we'll show you how we did that in the end. And that really feeds into an understanding of archives on the African continent, which are mostly colonial archives, and to really subvert that by saying we need to understand that who can create a record is always dependent on social, political, and economic resources. And for the longest time under colonial rule, colonial archives were meant to either invisibilize particular people or to create hypervisibility, but with the idea of a colonial project in mind. So also by using these kind of very creative ways of doing new archives with young queer people, we're also wanting to subvert the colonial archives and do practical decolonial work.
Yeah, I mean, to say the colonial archives obviously aren't just the archives from actual colonialism and apartheid, but also ongoing narratives linked, for example, to British colonial laws that still criminalize homosexuality or same-sex sexuality, and related to that, trans people. So this image is of what a typical day in the workshop looked like. So this is an example of people doing body mapping, and I thought it would be cool just to show you a little bit of what the process actually looked like. So people had a lot of time to work by themselves, and we used different prompts or, in some cases, guided meditation to help people think about what they wanted to put on the page. And then we used these initial images to help us determine what themes we wanted as a group. So everybody got together and we spoke through people's individual works, and then we said, okay, well, what are the big themes that can come out of this for you? And so big ones were spirituality, the relationship of religion, whether Christianity, Islam, or traditional African religions, and queerness, family, familial rejection, familial support, and then sex, sexuality, dating, romance, relationships. And so what we did was we honed down the particular kinds of stories that we wanted to tell. We asked, well, if you were reading something or if you had access to something, what are the things you want to hear? What are the stories you want to tell within these big themes? And then we spoke about the spread of the themes and what we wanted the book to look like. We kind of went back and forth a bit because we thought initially we might get different people to work together to make a fictional story that was kind of based on real experiences. And then it became more and more apparent that people really wanted to tell their own stories and that they weren't so interested in creating fictional accounts, but were more interested in talking about particular incidents or episodes from their own lives. And that then was also quite a long process. How do you get like just that little piece that's going to be made into a comic and separate that out from the whole long trajectory of your life or idea of your identity? So you'll see from the images at the bottom, those are mental maps, so where we asked people to map their neighborhoods, and then the ones above are the body maps. And when we mapped both bodies and neighborhoods, we included virtual and emotional spaces, bodily and neighborhood spaces. So social media was a big feature, especially because of criminalization or social stigma. People use social media a lot to connect with each other. But also in Kenya, for example, there's a big concern about blackmail. So people use anonymous social media accounts because they're afraid that people will find out who they are and blackmail them. threaten to out them. So this is an example of how participants' initial drawings translated to what became a page of a comic work. And what we really struggled with was being faithful to participant ideas and representation, because they scripted the comics, but also creating an output that we could have in a bookstore or, you know, supply through NGOs that would be interesting and aesthetically pleasing and sort of more mainstream, because we didn't want to make something we wanted to make something that people would be happy to buy or to get for free. And so what participants did was they scripted their stories, and often they drew little images themselves. Some people just said, I can't draw, I won't draw, I don't feel comfortable drawing. But other people did draw. And so this is an example of a story about somebody going to a family meeting where essentially they were outed, so being confronted by their family. And what was really important to them in telling the story was the layout of the room, because they were talking about how they walked in and they were confronted by this, you know, panel of people, but also how they were thinking about how they were going to leave the situation, how they were going to escape. So the layout of the room was really important. So I think the artist did a really good job of representing that visually. And then the idea of the father and him being this, like, dominating person at the center of the panel. Another thing that I think is really interesting is we asked people to draw themselves or draw characters in their stories. And we said, you don't have to draw yourself as a person. You can draw yourself as whatever you want. So in this particular scene, this person drew themselves as an ice block melting, because they felt that they were melting under the gaze of their family and, like, the pressure that they were experiencing. And so the artist then took that, and they didn't make them an ice block, but they made the person melt and used their dialogue of their father telling them to get out. And it's not in this one, but the father asks, like, why are you melting like an iceberg? And then another example is somebody who said, I can't draw, then went on to draw this amazing comic using emoji. And so the artist just took that and put bodies on them and used their dialogue and their scenes using the emojis. I feel like I'm talking for a really long time, so I'm going to go a little faster. Somebody else wanted their whole story to be told from the perspective of a cat. So you have them drawing themselves as a person, then as a cat, and then, the artist representation of them. And we also asked them what were really important characteristics to include. So for this person, it was the septum piercing. So there's septum piercing in all those iterations of the cat. And then that is the cover of our book, eventually. And so you'll see that it's under the name Kintu Collab, and we'll talk a little bit about how we got to that name and why shortly. I think I've covered a lot of stuff about themes.
Yeah. Just sort of to reiterate what came through content-wise in all these stories and in the workshops really were, I think, not very surprisingly, themes, I mean, what young people are concerned about, right? Family, both supportive family, but also often violence within families, stories of being forcibly outed, being kicked out of home, but also stories of being really supported by a parent.
Or sibling.
Yeah. Right. Everything about relationships, first dates, first sex, first love, friendships, you know, relationships that ended, relationships that started, and the excitement of new relationships. Quite a few issues around mental health, and I think that fits in with living in often really, really difficult circumstances. But in the same breath, I also want to say a lot of, like, essentially all stories about resilience, about living and surviving and having fun despite it all in difficult circumstances. Mm-hmm. And stories that really deal with the ambiguity of sort of trying to figure out an identity in contexts where that identity is often seen as not part of the context, right? So sort of feeling committed to both traditional roles or customs, which are often very patriarchal, but also to queer life and love and sex and sort of trying to figure out, you know, when you're 18, 19, 20, how this can all work and how you can be all of those things together.
But also not identifying necessarily with Western narratives about queer culture or coming out, and wanting to maintain a lot of those things in traditional culture or family values that are really important to people, and to find a way to make that sit uncomfortably alongside queerness or feeling rejected or alienated. Yeah.
And if you would have seen that the title of the book is Meanwhile with the three dots. And we chose the title because it, on the one hand, is a very typical comic caption, you know, meanwhile, and you see what's happening in one panel and the other panels, like something simultaneous is happening. But also because it means something that happens while we wait for something else. And a lot of the stories that people told were stories about just everyday life and small events in their lives that happened while we wait for laws to be changed, or we wait for politicians to rant on about how un-African queerness really is. While all these large events play out on the bigger stage, and while that's what we often see when the African continent and queerness on the continent is represented, meanwhile, all these small moments and gestures are also happening.
Lauren Berlant talks about life in the impasse, like living in that interim moment she's talking about in the impasse of neoliberal capitalism. But I think in this case, this idea of, you know, everyday life in the moment in between, that like what next moment after you get kicked out of your house, like what now, or after your first partner breaks up with you, or once the law has changed, or while waiting for the law to change, that like in-betweenness, I think, was really, really present in all the stories that were told. And so it wasn't about like arriving at a destination, like coming out, now I'm queer, and like, or it was kind of against this it gets better narrative, and more like, this is just it. Like, it just goes on and on and on and on. And sometimes it's easy and sometimes it's hard. Mostly it's hard. So yeah. That's the title.
And I think just two things we wanted to highlight also as issues and challenges in trying to do such a project is, on the one hand, talking about what people have called the imagined audiences, and the idea that even if we do work like this that's very creative or very participatory, that young people create themselves, that we have some kind of authentic product, which we don't really, right? Because everything people produce, they do with an audience in mind. So I think it's also something for us to reflect on, to think about who did people have in mind when they drew their or scripted their comics, and what does that mean for what they actually presented here?
And people were also very clear that they knew that they were talking to a funder. It's a funded project. We worked through NGOs. And so a lot of the young people had an existing relationship with the NGOs. So they kind of knew, you know, some of the beef that the NGOs had. Like, there's only money for men who have sex with men, and there isn't money for women's projects or trans projects. And so they were very clear about, like, who they were talking to. And you could often see the dialogue unraveling either, like, they were saying, like, F you to the funder, or they were trying to appeal to the funder, or they were talking to like a global Western, often Western audience, or people on the continent. So they were often very clear on who they were engaging. And so one difficulty we had often was, in the beginning, we kept saying, it doesn't always have to have a happy ending. Like, you can't tell sad stories, because there was this pressure to kind of, we don't want people to see us as abject. We also don't want other queer young people on the continent to read this and like be like, oh, there's no hope. So to find a balance was really hard.
Mm-hmm. And I guess the other big issue for us, and Talia already alluded to it, is the question of anonymity. Mm. So on the one hand, we're working in contexts where, I mean, being queer isn't criminalized. It's not illegal to be gay, and that's an important thing. It's illegal to have gay sex. Often that's intentionally confused by police, by lawmakers, by the general public. But nothing that we did with all these young people was illegal. It's not illegal to talk about being gay.
I don't think we said they're between the ages of 18 and 24. So.
Right. But at the same time, these contexts mean that there is a lot of stigma and a lot of discrimination. Hardly anybody was out to most people in their lives because it comes with a great risk. And people spoke about that risk in their stories. What that meant for us from the very beginning was that we had to think very, very carefully about the safety of the people we've worked with. Right? So that was one of the reasons why we decided to have a comic output, because comics can be very anonymous. We don't have faces. We have no other identifying information. But at the same time, it allows people to sort of create a representation of themselves that's often a safer representation in that context. It was also why we decided against film, for example, and thought podcasts can be a much safer medium because you only have a voice. Where necessary, you could even distort that voice a little bit if there was a concern. We've encouraged people to use pseudonyms if they didn't want their own names used. And that's why, in the end, we said, well, we cannot publish this under individual names, because for a lot of people, they said, well, I can't put my name to my story.
And we didn't want some people to have their names on and not others.
Yeah.
Because that's obviously unfair to people who aren't out.
So we had the discussion with the group. We decided on the name of a collaboration. So the Kinto Collab came out as the name under which this is going to be published. And then we'll have, at the end of the book, a list where one of the artists will draw everybody's face, but in a drawn way. So again, it's sort of anonymized. And then we've asked people to supply names and bios as they wish. So some people will use their real names. Some people will use a pseudonym. And people can just, they themselves can decide how they're represented in that.
Some people will use their Instagram handles.
Yes.
Because they have Instagram accounts. So there's somebody who goes by Kenyan Baby Dyke. They have Instagram accounts where they're very out, and they have a big social media presence, and they have a podcast, but they're not out under their given name. So people identify as they want. Yeah.
But that, of course, then raises questions for us also in terms of how are we going to exhibit the work. And we've been very transparent in the process. Every decision that we've made sort of around what kind of output do we have, where do we present outputs, has been always made with the whole group. So there's been lots of emailing with everybody, emailing with like 18 young people.
WhatsApping, WhatsApp calls.
Yeah. But, of course, those are then the bigger questions we have to think about.
And it does mean at the end of the day it's Alex and I standing up here and not those the 18 young people. But we are going to have some events where in Cape Town and Nairobi and Johannesburg, where people who can come will come, and we're going to try and we're going to fund that. But again, it privileges people who are out, and there isn't a lot that we can do about that. So, yeah.
Right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Wow, these sessions go together so well, and I'm glad we have time to discuss it. I will just try to facilitate and make sure you all get a chance to ask your questions. Does anyone want to dive in first? Oh, yes.
Yeah, I'm the volunteer for this session, but I have a question. I really loved both of your presentations, and I'm a arts educator living in Berlin, so I'm from Australia, but I'm working here in the arts. And so listening to both of your presentations, I thought, oh, there's so many people I want to tell this about, other people working in arts education and concerned with questions especially around diversity in the Berlin landscape for arts education for young people. So I want to ask, like, how would you feel about your work for, let's say, a Berlin audience, like sharing what you're producing, if someone was to, like, even to share it as a material? Because I thought that's great, thinking of zines, for example, and their queer history, which there's lots of zine workshops happening in Berlin, and I haven't done one myself, but I'm wondering if, for example, the queer history of that format comes forward, you know? So that would be something that I would encourage other arts educators to do. And then, like, even the comic then from South Africa is such a great example of something. So if someone was running a workshop and they had examples of comics by young people, if yours was included, but I thought this was a great opportunity to ask for your opinions about how you maybe see your work in a more international context and how you feel about that.
That's a really interesting question. I think just being here really excites me because I love zines. I just cannot, they're amazing. The projects are amazing. Coming up with creative ways to protect, especially youth, to capture their stories, and to work with different parts of the community to put it together. It's unbelievable. It's an amazing experience. And I think it would be, I mean, the more reach that these kinds of projects have throughout the world, the better, I think. Does that answer your question, I think?
Yeah, so
I think for us, we were quite clear from the beginning. Is this on? Yeah. Quite clear from the beginning that we wanted this to have quite a wide audience, particularly on the continent. That was most important for us. So our publishing agreement allows for us to disseminate the work free to NGOs on that we've worked with, so in the three countries, and also for the young people that we worked with to get a certain number of copies, blah, 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 blah. But we're selling them to the global north to help subsidize future print runs for dissemination on the continent. And they should be out by September this year. We're wrapping it up at the moment. We're really happy to share the work and for people to share the work. And it'll also be freely available online in 3 years.
Yes.
Yeah, 3 years.
How do you want to handle questions? Do you, they have to go to the mic?
We can hear, yeah, though. I mean,
is it okay? Quite,
yeah, I also don't really feel like I need this.
Okay. The thing is there a possible plan for digitizing the zine?
Oh, good point. So there is, actually. And because we're
in. Could you hear in the back? The question was, is there a plan to digitize the zines?
Yep. There's. What we're planning on doing, we haven't started it yet. It'll probably start maybe after the next one or two zine making workshops that we do. We're going to have we're going to put the entire process online so that people can follow it. Almost like a, if you want to call it, almost like a roadmap, where each time we have a zine making workshop, we'll add the images, where we were, how many people or youth were in attendance, their average ages, that kind of thing, so that people can follow the work. When the zines are actually created, and let me just clarify, when we have the zine-making workshops, the youth don't leave with an actual zine. They're creating something, they're giving it to us, we're kind of storing it at the moment, but when it builds up and the more workshops we have, it's going to end up being a collaborative zine that we're going to then distribute, you know, 50 copies to each organization for them to give back to the youth or to the community, that kind of thing. So the process is going to be online at some point in the future on our website, lambdaarchives.org, if you want to note that. But yes, they will be digitized. The website? lambdaarchives.org. Yeah. So, and it'll, we have obviously other of our collections and links to those, but that the zine project will be something you can follow on there as well.
I'm working for an LGBT youth magazine in Switzerland, and you mentioned that balance between, like, let someone have their own authentic voice, but also make something pretty and nice out of it. And that's a point where I always struggle a lot, because we're mainly having texts. And these young people are writing so many, like, very creative things, but it's mostly impossible to publish it like that. And we're also having state funding and so on. And so I know that question as well. And how did you manage that? Because I often feel like I'm cutting their voices when I correct these things, and I feel like I'm selling them out. And I wanted to ask how did you handle this? Or also, yeah, no, you did not correct anything in your scenes. They just...
No.
Yeah.
We even had the first zine-making workshop that we had. We had a youth that drew something. It was kind of like a stick figure, and that had a question mark on the face. And they said, mine's so ugly in comparison to everybody else's. And I felt bad. But it's really not about that. It's really whatever this means to you, do it. It's fine. It doesn't matter what it is. So, but a lot of ours don't have text. That's the other thing, is that a lot of us, they were doing, like, painting and drawing, so.
Yeah, I think in a way, similarly, it has been a bit easier because there wasn't a lot of text per se. But what we try to do, even in that process where the artists sort of changed some of the narratives or changed a little bit of the scripting, is that it's a very iterative process we've had with the whole group. So every new iteration of a particular story went back to the entire group for feedback. and then, you know, it would come back to the artists and us, and the artists would make suggested changes, and then we send it back to the group for feedback again. Which, of course, still, I mean, we're still altering, but we've really tried to keep the ownership through that process, which, I mean, look, isn't an easy process. It takes very long. Often people didn't give as much feedback as we had hoped for. You know, people would say, oh, this is great, I love it. I'm like, well, but that's not helpful. You know, and I would rather have somebody say, oh, can you change this again and change that back? And I don't particularly like how you've represented this part of my story. But we didn't get that much feedback from that, yeah.
I also want to add, though, you're totally right. Like, we totally, I mean, and I think this is why zine making is so amazing, is because it's unadulterated. But we had a particular format in mind, and we worked with artists who we trusted, and I think the group trusted, who we felt could be faithful to their stories. And the podcasts are then meant to be sort of the antidote to that, to be like their literal voices that they have recorded themselves. Some of it's like people playing Never Have You Ever, so it's taking really long to edit that into something that, because, you know, they had a few drinks and then they were less concerned about anonymity and privacy. And so it's taken us a long time to work through that. But ideally, we want them to be seen together, because a lot of the stories that are in the comic are told first person in the podcast. So they work well together, and they kind of sidestep that problem, because we're not having direct outputs in one, but we are in the other. But then in the back of the comic book, I don't know how many of you read comics, but it's quite traditional in the back of comic books to have process pictures with like little captions, so you see how a character develops or you see how an idea develops. So we had that. We have that where we show the participants' drawings also at the back of the book.
It's not so much a question necessarily, it's just I've got a situation where I could probably apply this. I work in a public library in Melbourne, and there's a large group of Sudanese refugee kids, a bit younger than what you're describing. Not necessarily queer, but it'd be good to have a space for that to be safe if necessary. So I was just wondering, like, you were talking about prompt questions in building the thing, because basically what's happening is... there's no free childcare in the area, so the library is kind of getting swamped by 40 kids every evening. And we like having them in the library, and we want to engage them and build connections with that community. But it's staffing and various things is making it difficult. And particularly since we're not teachers, we don't have their names, we don't have their contact details. Doing something like this would be a really good way to build a bridge with that community. So I think you mentioned prompts and things about, like, how would you start this process of building, like, a zine or a comic book with the kids, especially with the younger kids. I think, like, the whole thing with the developing the children's drawings into art stuff was really interesting. But anyway, I've talked too long.
We have used a lot of exercises from this amazing book that is published by Gala, and I think it's available online, maybe even for free. And it's Creative Methods for, I don't know the exact title, but it's like Creative Methods for Working with Queer Youth. And they use a lot of these things. We adapted them for the context, but it's a great resource, and it has a whole range of different activities that you could use. So that would be my recommendation, but also email us and we can tell you exactly what we did.
Little game things, yeah.
Yeah.
And I think there are a lot of, because the idea of the prompts for me came up, I don't know what I was Googling about having a zine making workshop, and at one point they said we just asked a question and turned the group loose, and it was up to their own interpretation, and that changed everything for me, because I don't know how I would have run the workshop otherwise, really, you know, and it's great, because it doesn't, I think especially with youth, they're a little, sometimes they're very shy, and some of the youth were as young as 12, 13, so really, really young. We just put the prompts on a wall, and they didn't necessarily have to talk about what they were writing about or drawing or anything like that. So I think especially when working with youth, the writing prompts are huge. And I don't think that would be difficult if you did, like, or contact either one of us or just did a search. But yeah, but it's key.
I'm Sapir from Israel, and I'm in touch with a Palestinian queer organization, which they're trying to develop seminars or summer camps for Palestinian queer youth. The problem is, and that's the educational approach of how can we do it, is that the supervisors, like the ones that are in charge of the organization, most of them are in the closet also. So how do you do educational work when almost all the participants in the organizations, the counselors and the out queer members, are in the closet and are very afraid to be discovered by the families, by the society, by some of them, the Israeli government or the army?
And I think that was a large concern for us from the outset. And I'm not saying that what worked in our context might necessarily work in yours at all. But I think one of the things we did right from the beginning is we didn't frame this for anybody outside the core group of participants. This wasn't framed as an LGBT workshop. This was a youth empowerment workshop. Right? I wrote letters to people's mothers confirming that they will attend a youth empowerment workshop, for example. So I think thinking very carefully about how the workshop is publicly represented to the extent that you have to represent it publicly. We were very clear, and we spent a lot of time at each of the workshops initially and on the first day around real rules for safety and security of everybody, sort of the safe space rules, and that included really discussing how we are not going to tweet about the event, for example, what the limitations are for picture taking. We knew exactly who was comfortable having their picture taken and who hadn't. And we sort of, as a general rule, always said, look, if you take pictures of the whole group, they're really just for your own phone in that matter. You know, they're not going to go on social media. We took one picture of the group that we wanted to have for everybody, and then we all covered our heads, for example. We all look like ghosts, but I mean, you know, so to think really, really carefully about what you can do to make it as safe as possible in terms of coming out.
Do you think the educational work is different when the counselors are also in the closet?
Yeah, I mean, that's not really something we can speak to because we haven't had, we were really lucky. I mean, we both identify as queer, and we were also really lucky. We worked through some great NGOs that are like queer NGOs. Mm-hmm. Although, funnily enough, they also have like weird names, like you know, human rightsy sounding names that don't mention LGBT or queer because of where they're based. But they're like very definitely queer organizations. So we didn't. So I actually don't. I don't really know how to answer that question. Yeah.
What will happen when the parents of these kids ask, like, what is the outcome and product of this wonderful youth empowerment workshop that you participated in?
Yeah, so we didn't say that there were going to be outputs. Like, we didn't, and most, I mean, it's important to say everybody was over 18, so they didn't need parental consent. But we had instances of people's parents taking their passports and, like, just, you know, bad behavior from people involved. And so the instance where Alex had to write a letter as Professor Müller from UCT, blah, 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 was somebody whose mother wasn't letting her go, but not because it was a queer workshop. She didn't want her to travel, I don't know, for some weird... she didn't want her daughter to travel alone to another country. And a lot of xenophobia, weirdly, from people who hadn't traveled before and their parents were anxious. So, like, we just lied to people. And, like, I'm unapologetic about that. These are adults. They should be able to travel if they want to. And if they're not out to their families, there was no way to ask for parental permission. Not that we needed it. And we had a lot of problems with UCT ethics because we had to go through the ethics board of our university, mm-hmm. who just, you know, had all the same kinds of nonsense, this is really bad PR, but nonsense, xenophobic ideas about, like, people in other African countries, and, like, also asked us, what are you going to do about parental permission? And we were like, these are adults. And we didn't tell the ethics board that we lied to parents, but, yeah, I mean, we did what we did, and I'm not sorry.
And we don't, I think, you know, I live in San Diego, we have the most... LGBTQ elected officials come from San Diego, in the state of California, more than San Francisco. The organizations that we're hosting, that we're having these workshops at, are all LGBTQ organizations. So we're pretty fortunate in that regard. Having said that, they're still youth. There are still considerations that need to be taken. And for example, when we started doing the workshops, one of the employees of our archive said, well, why don't you do a Facebook event notifying people that this is going to take place in advance? And we shut that down before it even started as a conversation. You can't do that, you know, because then you don't know who's going to show up. You don't know what they're going to be doing, if their intent is to take photographs to cause harm, to exploit the children, even if they're maybe what they feel is, you know, not a harmful intent. It still ultimately is to, we have a responsibility, ethical considerations to protect the youth as much as possible. So.
So just thinking about then that issue of privacy and safety, how did you actually, and especially for your project, how did you identify the participants in the first place? If these organizations are kind of not openly advertising it as a queer project, how did you know that you were going to get the right kind of people?
So we left that up to the three organizations who we know really well and we've worked with in the past. And we just said, look, we want to host this workshop. That's the idea of the workshop. Can you advertise it in ways that will work and find people? And I think in Botswana and Kenya, the NGOs very openly said, we're looking for LGBT participants. It's a youth project, but only within their own communication channel. So on like a closed Facebook group, for example. So it's sort of pre-filtered there. I think a lot of also just went through word of mouth, through emails by people. And we had asked the young people to apply. So we had created an email address. We asked young people to apply because we wanted to have a sense also of who would be there, right? And it's also a safety measure in the same respect. Like, we have to make sure that we don't have any weird straight homophobe who just wants to infiltrate the workshop, right? But
yeah, I mean, we obviously ended up with a big bias in that, like, most of the people who came to the workshops had some experience with the NGO before, because we were working with a relatively closed pool, because we didn't advertise publicly, we didn't advertise outside the NGO workshops. We also had, like, only men in Botswana. We had one gender non-conforming person, and then all other gay men. And then in Kenya, we had only women and one man. And that was because after the experience in the one country, we put word out, we're like, we want more women and non-conforming people. And because of the way the word of mouth thing worked, it seemed to only circulate amongst women. So it just was kind of, snowball, random.
And then for our project, like, we really relied on our community partners, like I said, you know, the San Diego Pride, the education and advocacy manager used to be the head archivist at Lambda Archives. I trust her. She trusts us. We have a great working relationship. We work together often, you know, and I knew they had programs in place for youth. It was really easy for us to just contact them and say, do you mind if we do this scene-making workshop? And it's similar to, you know, we're going to have one at the LGBT Community Center in San Diego, so we're pretty fortunate to have kind of like that built-in, it's just sending an email and saying, do you want us to come do this on a Saturday, and we'll bring pizza and hang out with the kids and do this, so.
I'm going to jump in and ask a question myself, if you don't mind. I was really struck by the generational issues you brought up about, you know, older people, probably in the category I'm in, you know, that falling into that pattern of saying, you know, young people just don't care about their history. And I was really struck by how creative your responses are, and in a way how what you're doing is very much like oral histories. It's like finding a way to document something that isn't getting documented through meeting minutes and correspondence, like finding a way to document something. I just offer that as a way to maybe explain what you're doing to the older people, because they'll understand what oral histories are about. But my question is thinking about, I think you also said people question, how is this history? Isn't this just
fun and games, kind of. But it is creating historical documents. So I guess my question, I don't know if you've seen it yet, is have you had anyone using the material you're creating from a scholarship kind of point of view, or in a way to write the history of these youth? Or can you, you know, how do you imagine these sources being used if they're in the archives in the future? Not just the published version, but, you know, the whole unedited podcast and everything. Do you see them as good historical sources?
One of the things we're doing that I think makes this, particularly in the future, for people to look back on and realize the significance of it, is that we're not only going to be collecting and preserving the finished product, we're also going to be keeping, I don't know if you want to call it kind of like a journal, on the days of the workshops, where we were, who was in the room, not names, but how many youth, how many adults, where we were, kind of like reflecting on the process and how that went. And that's going to be part of the collection in the archive. So I think, like I said earlier, I do think there's benefit in saying that just because, you know, something isn't old, if you want to call it old, you know, it doesn't have historical, it doesn't not have historical significance. And the process itself, it really is history in the making. It will be preserved, and I don't know if people have to wait 30 years before they're impressed by it and call it history, but I think there's more to it than that. So,
yeah, I mean, very honestly, I hadn't necessarily thought of how we're documenting the entire process. That's also probably because I'm a researcher and not necessarily an historian. I mean, we've worked with Gala, the Gay and Lesbian Archives in Johannesburg, in publishing the book, and I think we could explore also giving them, I mean, they have the largest queer archive on the continent, so that might be an opportunity to give something there. I think we would need to check with all participants and really think about what form that could have, that also sort of, you know, as always, guarantees safety and anonymity. But I like the idea of almost like a reflective part or like a journal of sorts that could have that.
You mentioned the whole perception of recruitment. If I say, in my context, if I was wanting to make a safe space for queer youth, and it's a very different part of Africa, so the context could be different. But if, like, one of the Sudanese kids wanted to come out, how, and my workplace would be much more supportive, it's a much more, the umbrella of the workplace is very queer friendly, but how would you go about dealing with the community with queer issues in a migrant context, if that makes sense as a question, I guess.
Yeah. I don't know. Yeah. I don't know the answer to that question. I mean, I think we were very clear in that we were working with the individuals, yeah, and that they were in a whole range of different places in terms of like outness or dealing with their families or communities, and we didn't mediate or engage in that process at all. I think for us it was really important that those people got to tell their stories, that they were supported in the space, and that if they needed to talk to somebody, even in the longer term, we're available via email, but also the NGOs we worked with are there. And I think what was really nice for them was, whilst a lot of people had previous contact with NGOs, we had somebody who had just decided like that they were queer or bi, and we had a few other instances where people weren't out at all, but they saw this thing and they thought, okay, I might go. And so for us it was really important that their needs were served in that process, that enabled them to engage with their families or communities if they wanted to. But we were also very clear, you don't have to, and it's a matter of safety, but also, like, safety issues aside, your life might just be easier if you don't, and that's totally fine also. So, yeah, I don't know.
And then for us, again, it just, we kind of rely on what the community partners already have built in. They're, you know, we just kind of show up and do the zine workshop, so that's not as much of a concern that's on our organization. It's already something that the community partner that we're going to have the workshop is already taken into consideration.
anyone else in the room have experience doing either zines or comics or some other alternative kind of creative way of documenting history that you want to share? Okay. Well, I will. Would you like to make any concluding comments after, you know, any thoughts come to you that you want to share before we end?
You know, I'll just really say when I read, we just met right before this took place, so it's not like we've known each other for any period of time besides this conference this morning. I was really intimidated by the bios. I don't know if you want to call it that or the work they were doing, but it is nice to share space with people from so far away from where we're from and see that, you know, there are similar projects, similar ethical considerations. I don't know. It's just kind of nice to hear the different takes on things. So, yeah, it's been really great to be here.
And I mean, I was really excited. We initially considered zines as one of the things we could do with the young people.
Well, we just didn't have enough space and time. We had to prioritize. But I mean, now seeing what you're doing, it does, I mean, besides the idea of archiving with Gala, the like reams and reams and reams of paper we've produced, I think zines might be an interesting way to use the material. But again, it requires going back to the 18 people and seeing, yeah, what's possible for everybody. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, yeah. Oh, that's one takeaway from this. It's really hard to collaborate with so many people. Yeah, right. It's impossible to make a thing, one thing or two things, with so many people in a short period of time. This is taking a really, really long time.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to thank you all and also thank the organizers who put your papers together and thank all of you for coming. It really is a treat to be here with all of you. Thanks. Thank you.